yesterday is representing Moses, representing Kelly, representing Foster, myself, Co-Chairman Meyer, Vice Chairman Stokel, representing Kutula, representing Hawker. Skews today is representing Jewel, representing Paul, and representing Schnell. I think the operating budget wore them out, so they went home for the weekend. Okay, today we have five bills that we've previously heard, and we held them over for to do a little work on them. I believe the work is complete. There may be some more amendments yet to come on some of these, and that's fine. But let's go ahead and get started with the first bill up, which is House Bill 266. This is vehicle weights and insurance. And then after that, we'll have the Senate Bill 172 initiative and referendum ballot summaries. House Bill 190, required ID for purchasing alcohol. House Bill 377, exemption for residential building drawings and specs, specifications. And then House Bill 278, retirement system bonds. So Representative Elkins, can you join us, please? Let's see what we have here. We have some questions. James Thompson, Dr. DOT. Okay, with that, the committee recalls this bill was in this committee previously on January 27th, and then it was referred back to the Finance Committee from the floor. We had the finance version in front of us, and so we have a sponsor, Representative Elkins, and his trustee staff, Jennifer. So with that, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Jim Elkins. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this bill. I was unhappy with the version when it hit the floor because I didn't take the time to familiarize myself with the bill because I wasn't here when you passed it out. But I, after a couple work sessions with Chairman Meyer discussing the problems I had with the bill, I came to the conclusion that the bill was fine and served all the purposes that I wanted it to achieve, and I would just encourage you to pass it out, and I apologize for the inconvenience.
Okay, Representative Elkins, any questions? Okay, so the finance version does meet your needs.
Yes.
You support the finance version. Okay, good. And then also for the record, Representative Wire has joined us. Two-thirds vote is needed. Yeah, it's not required anymore. Okay. Very good. Any questions for Representative Elkins? Seeing none, I would like to ask Mr. McKinley of DOT if he can stay with Representative Elkins, if he would like to. I just want to thank Representative Elkins. I just want to thank you for putting this bill through, Representative Elkins. I think this is really important, and I appreciate your you doing this. And I'm coming to the idea.
Thank you.
Mr. McKinley, DOT supports this.
For the record, John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Highways for Transportation for Highways and Facilities. Yes, Mr. Chairman, the department does support this. We worked with the trucking industry. Our Aves Thompson, our head of commercial motor vehicles, have an agreement with them that this is an increase in the fine structure as well as enforcement abilities, and they do support this bill as well as the department.
Okay, and I understand we do have Aves online for questions, but it's my understanding that if there is one trucking outfit or one trucking company that maybe is more excessive than others, that Aves has the ability to investigate them at any time?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. In the existing regulations, there is the ability.
Very good. Okay, thank you. I don't have any other questions. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead,
Michael. So this is a dredging pack in the primary before us a couple months ago now. I believe I, of course, I asked Mr. Thompson a question about the availability of scales in the Chugach area with a lot of gravel commerce. And I believe his answer was that there aren't there aren't scales in all the major pits there. If he's online, refresh my memory on that.
Okay. Mr. Thompson, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, yes, this is Aves Thompson. I'm the Director of Commercial Vehicle Enforcement in the Department of Transportation. And in response to the question, we did some checking, and there are not pits at, there are not scales at all pits, but there are scales at the larger pits, and we're working to develop a strategy to ensure that the vehicles that are operating within the accepted weight limits.
If I might, and it's because of some of the environmental conditions that can shift the weights of loads, despite the best intents, I don't want to have a situation where we're potentially putting an onus on small operators who operate out of these. I will take this good intent and effort that they're endeavoring, that the Department of Transportation is endeavoring to make sure that help make sure the tools are available to help better compliance. And I see nodding from the Deputy Commissioner and his manager's words.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Abe, since we have you here, the major difference between the transportation version and the finance version was the pattern of or practice of violation or the multiple offender. Is it your feeling that section isn't necessary because you already have the ability to go after the multiple offender?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There's authority in the law that allows the division director to institute an investigation based on a complaint or an observed practice.
Okay, very good. And so you're supportive of the finance version also?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, sir. I wanted to thank the sponsor for this bill and the staff there. I'll go ahead and move out of Finance Committee HB 266 for the adoption of zero fiscal notes and with individual recommendations.
Any objection? Seeing none, they'll pass that committee. Thank you, Representative. Okay. Let's move on then to Senate Bill 172. Initiative referendum ballot subject. Senate Bill 172. The committee heard Senate Bill 172 on March 8th. We did take public testimony and closed it. Asked Mr. Brewster to be available here to discuss the fiscal that we have changes to understand. There is a blank CS before the committee, so let me get a motion if I could.
Thank you. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Co-Chairman Meyer. The CS that has been adopted by the committee for discussion contains really two essential changes to it. The first is in the House Judiciary version of the bill, there is a requirement that the summary be 100 words for each section of the initiative. The committee substitute adopted by the committee changes that from 100 words per section to 50 words per section. The second fundamental change in the CS is that it requires the Division of Elections to prepare and publish a pamphlet for the primary election if there is an initiative that will appear on the ballot. There is already a requirement in state law that the Division of Elections prepares a pamphlet for the general election ballot, so nothing was omitted there, except for in the description of what must be contained in the pamphlet, the summary must contain a description 50 words or less in the description of the initiative for each section that appears in the initiative.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Cunningham, any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I promise to be gentle with questions. It was just a point of clarification. The 100 words for each section clause here, is that to be interpreted as each section of the bill has no more than 100 words, or that the initiative bill being proposed, say it's 7 sections, that would be 7 times 100, no more than 700 words for the entire bill, or is it 100 words per section more or less?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that is correct. When preparing the summary, the Division of Elections could, in describing each section of the initiative, could not use more than 50 words, and in this, because we did change that, that's correct. Yes, no more than 50 words. It may be 10 words, but they can use no more than 50 words in describing that section.
It's not an aggregate then.
There is no aggregate limit that is set on this.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, it is a technical correction. My name is Annette Kreitzer. I'm Chief of Staff to Lieutenant Governor Lehman, and it is the Lieutenant Governor's job to make this description. It is not the Division of Elections. I just wanted to clarify that that's who we're talking about.
If I may enter, I do want to come down on this to make sure that I'm absolutely clear. I'm kind of foggy here. I've been budget yesterday. I'm still pretty covered. The meeting with Representative Jim it was, as you would envision, I propose an initiative petition. And coming before you, to the Lieutenant Governor's office, to write the description. The initiative has 7 sections in it. Making 7 times 50 is 350 words. Can you use 350 words to describe the whole bill, or do you have to identify each section and only have 50 words to describe each of the 7 sections in my initiative?
The Chair, Representative Hawker, this is Annette Kreitzer again. Because there are 3 women up here, I think I'll do that every time I speak, so it's very clear in the recording who's speaking. the way that I interpret this, the way the Division of Election interprets this, is that it's 50 words per section. And so if we have a seven-section initiative, then we would be looking at, the Lieutenant Governor would be looking at 50 words per section. And obviously, we have testified before where you have a an effective date clause. It doesn't take 50 words to describe an effective date. And so it is the latitude of Lieutenant Governor to use up to 50 words to describe each section of an initiative or a referendum, because this law does cover, the change does cover referendums as well.
Okay, sounds fair. I've got a seven-section initiative bill, and there's one section that has all of the substance of the initiative in it, and then there are six others that's an effective date, a contingency clause, whatever, I mean, they're ministerial points. I only get 50 words to describe the section that has all the guests in it, and 50 words apiece for those other six sections that one of them is just the effective date.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, again, this is Annette Kreitzer. I understand your point. In the way that I read the CS and the way I've read the bill before it and the way I've heard it described in committee, that is the case. The Lieutenant Governor would be provided no more than 50 words to describe each section.
Each individual section.
Correct. Through the chair, correct.
And if I may, we wrestled with this idea, Representative Hawker. The concern is that we have too many words and don't put a limit on it, that people can spend all day voting with it, and people will get discouraged and not vote. So we're trying to strike a happy balance here. Now, one thing that this bill does require now is information template that can be set out prior to, so that hopefully they'll get more detail from that, and when they go to the voting group, they won't need as much detail.
I completely concur, and I also suggested that approach here at the last meeting. But
again,
make sure that's what you want this bill to do.
I'm here.
That's your choice.
Well, Representative Hawker, through the chair, the legislature is going to make a policy call here. And the Lieutenant Governor and the Division of Elections are going to carry out that policy call.
Most just have to ask the sponsor agree with that interpretation. You follow the same time he came my question, and secondly, do you agree with the interpretation as been given in testimony?
For the record, my name is Joe Balash, staff to Senator Terrio. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Representative Hawker, the sponsor, did go over this with the co-chair yesterday. He does support the approach that has been suggested here, and he does understand the difference on the limitation per section. Yes, he does understand that.
Thank you, sir. That's all I need to know. Appreciate that.
Very good. Any other questions? Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Balash is here. I think I asked in the last session, I think it's been a visit for someone to visit the office. What are the other 50 states doing with this government? We're not going to bend the wheel up here. What are they doing?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, that is the first time I've heard that question. I'd be happy to do some research on that unless somebody else knows the answer.
It seems to me that we're the end of the road here, and if I want to have somebody else, or a whole bunch of somebody else, do this, would help you with the fiscal. It's a lot better here than it was before, but that would help me. I know we don't care in Alaska what the answer is.
We don't care what the answer is,
but I would have to ask.
All right, we do have amendment two. Here's Representative.
So I'll move the amendment?
Sure.
Okay. I move the amendment and the bill because it was done quickly to try to coordinate with the new CS. But let me tell you what I wanted to do. I like the idea of having the information in the voters' pamphlet. I think that's a great idea. I think that's something we should have been doing. And I actually really don't care how long the information is in the voters' pamphlet, because that's when I think people will actually So it would be just the 100 words, completely, not per section, not longer. I don't care about the title. I mean, the 25 words per title, that seems pretty valid to me, too. And 6 words is going to be short. So if you want to have a longer title, but, you know, I'm just looking at by the time somebody's sitting at the ballot, they're going to read the whole thing, even if it is just 50 words, and I appreciate it. I think that's a really good step in the right direction. So the amendment was meant to leave the 25-word title alone, but to limit the description still to just 100 words total max. I also wanted to leave the new pamphlet alone. I think that's a great idea. Where it made it tricky with the amendment, and this is with conceptual Parkinson, is that I think that there's an interplay with the way that the CS is written between taking what's in the pamphlet verbatim back into the ballot. That's the conceptual part. I think they all have to work together. So right now, so I would make a distinction between that. I would let the pamphlet stand on the ballot being the second, or the referendum or initiative. So that's the amendment. It's kind of cutting it a little bit again and half. I think the pamphlet's good. Thank
you.
Mr. Chairman, the sponsor is quite satisfied with the product of the committee.
It's an important point being brought up in the conceptual amendment that I would view that's the right operative group. But you can perhaps, initiative petitions have grown to be just literally entire to codify sections of statute with incredibly complex provisions. I mean, we've got one here that's, 7 pages standard text. I think the other one that's coming up this year is, at least 8 pages or a dozen pages of standard text. Hugely complicated, sophisticated. These aren't simply putting an item on the ballot that says, a petition for, want to name March 23rd Alaska Legislature Day or something. These are so complex that it absolutely warrants giving the Lieutenant Governor the expanded ability to get the substance of what the voter's voting on in the voter's face when they're making that decision. And certainly it's also incumbent on the Governor to utilize the authority sparingly. I do truly believe the Lieutenant Governor used that authority sparingly and efficiently, in that less is probably more when they are presenting that before the public. But certainly, you've got a 30 or 40 section bill that's 8 to a dozen pages long, saying you've got to explain this whole thing to the public in 100 words, it's just no longer realistic. So I respectfully would not be able to support the amendment.
Very good.
Just finally, I'm not so sure I don't agree with Senator Cochran in terms of the initiative for referendum and stuff, but it's really my biggest concern is the ballot. Because by the time we get to the ballot box, they're not going to read it. There's just no way. So, I'd be open to amending the amendment, but that's probably for another date. So, I think that less is more, and I think that's hard to do, but I would put all of this information forward, and finally, it will save money. Thank you.
Thank you. Certainly, can't disagree with it. It would save money, but I think our hope here is that either through the information pamphlet they can send to their home or on the ballot itself, that the information will get in front of the voters so that they can make the most educated, wisest decision possible. So, and if that's going to cost a little extra money to do that,
I certainly agree with the chair about the pamphlet, but I really think that the extra language on the ballot won't make a difference. It will make it more expensive and probably more confusing. So we can talk about this more later.
Sorry. Very good. Okay. So we'll check here. Okay.
two Nagarine on it, so I think there may have been an amendment already.
Okay, yes, yes. There is already an amendment.
Yes, this is
the Ms. Cunningham?
This is supposed to be two or
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number one from the initial hearing was not offered, so this amendment we labeled amendment number two.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then have two Representative Capullos. Okay. Secretary.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Capullos?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yeah.
Representative Stoltz?
Yeah.
Representative
Weirach? Yes.
No.
Okay. So then the two fails. Any other amendments come to force? Okay. If not,
some of the debate on the other side here has me concerned that that balance, if we put a lot more words in there, then it appears as if or looks as if it's the whole content. That would be misleading, and so that's where I'm a bit in that direction, and then to Representative Parker's discussion with the sponsor, having more than we have now. We certainly need more than we have now. But I would just ask, I don't want to stop this from moving, not suggesting that, but I think if the sponsor would get the 50 state information back, I'm a little worried here that we do something without somebody being able to tell us how it's being done elsewhere. I hesitate to make the law here that's so important relative to the public that we can't sit here and tell one another about 50 other states or 49 other states.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Would you have that information, questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director for the Division of Elections. Through the Chair, Representative Kelly. I know that the municipality of Anchorage, at least, has the full language of their ballot measures on the ballot. I've heard mixed reaction to that.
Right, Mr. Chair. Maybe that information could be brought forward to rules or somewhere so that somebody does a check on that. I just think it's worth knowing what that what's happening.
If you are uncomfortable, so actually think here that you can always make an amendment on the floor.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I think we're allowing quite a bit of latitude here to the Lieutenant Governor's office. Certainly, up to 50 words. If you can say two words, that's great. Some topics are obviously more complex than others. We need to have some flexibility. Okay, do we need to discuss the fiscal note at all? We have a new fiscal note for $97,000. Is that for the campaign itself? Okay. Small.
Thank you. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Representative Meyer. In discussing with the Division of Elections and the Lieutenant Governor's Office regarding the changes made in the committee substitute adopted by the Finance Committee, particularly the provision that requires them to print a pamphlet if there is a primary, there's an initiative on the primary election ballot, they prepared a cost estimate of what it would cost the Division of Elections to do so. That is what fiscal note dated 3/24/06/1:27 p.m. indicates, and there is a supplemental to that, a second page to that, which details the personal services and the contractual cost. In our continuing discussions about the evolution of this bill, the Division of Elections has very real concern as well as the Lieutenant Governor's office, that every year there are a different number of initiatives of differing lengths that may appear on a ballot. By going to a per-word section cap of words, it may potentially drive it over onto a second ballot, and they will not know until a ballot summary is prepared by the Lieutenant Governor's office to go onto the ballot. In my discussion with the co-chairman of finance, we thought it would be reasonable to move the bill out with two accompanying fiscal notes for the Division of Elections. One dated 2/10/06, which indicates the cost associated with going to a second page of a ballot that was based on the costs that were incurred in the 2004 general election when the Division of Elections was required to provide ballot space for initiatives that were sponsored by the municipality of Anchorage. And then also to carry with it this fiscal note for the $97,000 for the pamphlet. In the case that something may happen in the other body during a, it's always kind of hard to step around this issue, in their deliberations of the operating budget for next year. In the conference committee where fiscal notes are rectified, if the appropriate action has been taken and there is a contingency for going onto a second ballot page, if the Division of Elections is taken care of, then the note dated 2/10/06 may be zeroed out at that time.
Very good. You want to avoid a supplemental as well, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Annette Kreitzer for the record. Well, you're correct, and as you well know, the Lieutenant Governor is a pretty frugal guy, and Lieutenant Governor Lehman certainly wouldn't want to be coming back to the legislature for a supplemental for costs that we could identify up front. And we do appreciate the committee working with us and understanding those concerns, and appreciate what you've done to address those.
Yeah, very good. Any other questions?
Yeah, I appreciate Ms. Kreitzer being here testifying. I also appreciate that the last director of elections was here during session to comment on election bills and bills, because I think it's very important to get that perspective. So I'm glad finally the director has shown up.
Thank you, Director. Yes, we do appreciate you being here. And I'll still ask the questions. Okay.
Yes, sir. I want to thank Suzanne and Annette for coming here today and coming here earlier. Listen, Dr. Ed, we brought up the finance committee SB 172. We attached this the most
from the Okay, any objections? See none? You'll pass the committee. Oh, pass the committee. Sorry, yeah, we got a pass the
Sorry, Joe.
Okay.
For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to co-chairman Meyer. In the committee substitute that was adopted by the Finance Committee, it does include a reference to election pamphlets, and that needed to be included in the title. So there will be an accompanying title change resolution that will accompany Senate Bill 172 to the next committee of referral.
Vice Chairman, that CS for House Bill number 490 Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did bring reinforcements with me today. Brought up the big guns here. So I'll be happy to let her explain the changes. And I think that your staff is going to explain the amendments.
We'll start with Ed, and I'll
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Heather Beatty, staff to Representative Crawford. I know you covered the changes from the judiciary version to the CS you were looking at last time, so I'll just highlight the changes from version X to version P. On page 2, lines 9 and 10, we added references to AS 2835030 and 2835032. This clarifies that the intent of the bill is that only persons convicted under Alaska's drunken driving and refusals to submit to breathalyzer statutes would receive a marked license if they were prohibited from drinking by the courts or a parole board.
Or state ID,
a marked driver's license or state ID. On page 3, line 3, you'll see that we added the description of the mark to be on the license as NEOC. This is to reflect the language that is commonly used in these court orders, which is not to enter or consume. We hope that this would help the Division of Motor Vehicles understand what it was that we were hoping to see on these licenses, and also help the licensees who sell alcohol to understand what it is they should be looking for. And the final change in version P is on page 3, lines 28 and 29, also page 4, lines 3 and 4. This incorporates amendment number 1 adopted by the committee in our last hearing, which clarified that it wasn't a person who was mandated to get a new license. It was that if they obtained a new license after receiving these court orders, the license must reflect the mark and other information that the bill would require. And that's all, unless you have any questions.
No, I don't. By the way, we did get a call from John Jones.
Just on that, I remember a little bit of the conversation the other day, but on the IP, the person has a problem, gets in, if the gentleman has a license without the mark, doesn't need another license for 6 years, they have to go down and get that changed, or is it 6 years without the change? I'm trying to figure this out.
They have to surrender that license at the time that they're stopped by the policeman or whatever. So to get a new license, it's going to have the mark upon it at that time.
So they won't drive again without the mark.
Right.
Okay, we do have Dwayne Bennett is online for questions. Okay, any other questions for the sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just familiarized myself. Section 1, Representative Crawford, I just want to make sure I'm clear on the intent. It's going to be the responsibility of the vendor, for lack of a better word, to check every person on the way in and make sure they have the right to.
This is voluntary, Mr.
Representative Stokes.
Okay. Thank you for that. And this is going to be some translations. I see the other part, and you can small materials and the other questions out of establishment that's primary heat that also serves alcohol.
Mr. Chairman, this is only to restrict them to for purposes of buying alcohol. They won't be restricted from entering to have a meal.
Mr. Chairman, it's only to have them try and consume it, not to purchase it, a package or on-site premises or such.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
I'm sorry, I was admonished, I wasn't talking loud enough to say yes.
Okay.
I said, no, I asked if this should go to a subcommittee.
Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor? If not, let's go ahead and get into the amendments. You guys can stay there. Just kind of hand it over and join us, please.
For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Co-Chairman Meyer. Amendment number two is actually drawn directly from the concern that Representative Stoltz just had with the ability of somebody going down to the hangar with a group of friends that may have a restriction on consumption ordered by a court and having these four letters NEOC on their driver's license. Well, that stands for no entry or consumption. This bill particularly gets to the fact that a court or the Alaska State Parole Board orders as a condition of probation or parole a restriction on consumption. So in working with the sponsor's office and working with our legal services, we thought it best to limit that marker to what it was they were getting at, which was the restriction on consumption. So we went with ROC and also defined in that section as an abbreviation for restriction on consumption. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When this bill first came before the committee, I had a very big concern about driver's licenses and identification cards. A person is allowed to have an identification card, a valid State of Alaska identification card, at the same time that they have a driver's license. And I was very concerned, in ordering to meet the intent of this bill, that the license, a state identification card, if a person is restricted from consumption, should also contain that mark during the person's probation or duration of parole. This amendment addresses the identification card of a person. When a person, this law only pertains to driving under the influence of alcohol or controlled substances and refusal to submit to a breathalyzer or a chemical test. A driver's license is often the first thing that is taken by an arresting officer at the time, and it's pretty hard to go through life without some kind of picture ID. So a person will go to the Division of Motor Vehicles, get an identification card that may be unmarked because they haven't been sentenced by a judge yet. Consequently, they get out of jail, they become eligible for a driver's license. Under this new law, if the court said there's a restriction on consumption for the period of your probation, and they go and get a license that's marked, they have in their possession a license that is marked, an ID card that is unmarked. And if a person has severe problems with alcohol, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out which one they're going to use to purchase alcohol. So this helps tighten up the, also having the license and the ID card match in nature with the restriction on it.
Okay, very good. Any questions on that?
Is
the sponsor okay?
We're just fine with it, Mr. Chairman.
Do you still have your objection,
Mr. Chairman? I've removed my objection to amendment 3.
Okay. Amendment 3 passes. Amendment 4. I'll move to amendment 4.
I will object for purposes of discussion, sir.
Okay. Very good.
Amendment 4 is actually a clarification that the Department of Corrections asked the sponsor to consider. On page 3, line 31, it requires the Department of Corrections to notify the Division of Motor Vehicles when a person has been ordered to refrain from consuming alcohol as a condition of parole. And through discussions with the Department of Corrections, it is actually the Alaska Parole Board that would be required to submit the required information to the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Fine piece of work, Mr. Chairman.
Any other concerns or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Alaska Parole Board is for administrative purposes, administered through and budgeted through the Department of Corrections. I'm wondering, as you work the conceptual memory, and this was conceptual, so we have a little latitude here, would it be appropriate, and again, not knowing how the Department of Parole Board might manage their administration anytime in the future, would it be appropriate to have it the Department of Corrections or the Alaska Parole Board?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I think that that conceptual amendment still remains with the intent, depending on how the administrative duty is divided between the Department of Corrections and the Alaska Parole Board. It's my understanding that in other cases where some kind of reporting or I'm trying to think of the word that the Department of Corrections used, information is actually administratively distributed from the Parole Board to...
Okay, I don't answer the question.
If I may, Heather Beatty, staff to Rep. Crawford, for the record, through the chair, Representative Hawker, the language for this amendment came directly from the Department of Correction, and their instruction to us was to replace the language in the bill with Alaska Parole Board. So we were just trying to meet their request in the way that they asked for it.
Absolutely fine. The Department of Corrections has been able to make mistakes in the past as well.
Okay, do you think your objection?
Mr. Chairman, no, I would be happy to remove my objection to amendment number 4.
Okay. Amendment 4. Yes. Amendment 5. I'll move to amendment 5.
I object for purposes of discussion, sir.
Okay. Discussion.
Amendment number 5 is one of those kind of technical and drafting nature type of amendments. When this version was released, the P version only pertained to crimes, only pertained to the driving under the influence and refusal to submit to a chemical test. So on page 3, line 22, just to clarify that it wasn't just a conviction of any crime, that it was a conviction of these two particular crimes. The same with the subsequent amendments. It just clarifies that a condition of parole for a conviction of these two particular crimes. And the last one on page 4, line 3, is actually came from the very good eyes of the sponsor staff. AS 2815760 doesn't exist. So the staff of the sponsor, in talking with legal services, clarified that it is actually AS 2815161 that should be referenced there.
Chairman, I would be also with that explanation. I'd be happy to do my objection to amendment number 5.
Very good. Any other amendments? Let's see, I have the
No, as I mentioned earlier, I had some concerns. The last time I said it was the first time I'd seen it, and my concerns have been dealt with. And I'm glad to hear that it was the largest wholesaler in the state of Alaska is interested in implementing this program, so I think that will help curtail and get some people off the roads that shouldn't be on the roads with alcohol. So, not a cure-all. It's not going to catch them all. We'll catch some. And, I know there is still going to be some cost to this, but I think the cost has been reduced somewhat. So I'm fine with this bill. Now, is there any other questions, concerns, comments?
Sure. Just figure out how to make sure they actually had a driver before they used to drive.
That's not the amendments I've seen in a long time, but just one question that they have under that is, is there any liability that would be on a vendor if they could check something bad occurs that they had to check? Is there any backlash there that could occur with the messenger?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly through the chair, it was not our intent to have liability on the vendor. We were careful, and on the record I want it to be known that what we're intending is for the responsibility to be on the offender, not on a vendor that's self. The vendor hasn't done anything wrong here. It's the offender that we want to prevent from buying alcohol.
Thank you, Chairman. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill has matured a lot. Quite a while. We probably don't even recognize what it's coming from, what it started with. But, that's the process we go through. I think it's matured to a point that it certainly warrants deliberation of up or down vote on the floor and moving through the process. But, I still have some personal reservations with the policy being established here. Because, again, this is scarlet letter concept. Driver's license or ID is mandatory in so many instances here that are unrelated to having been convicted, have the DUI and essentially having your license branded with a scarlet letter that says this person, committed a bad crime. When you go to the bank and they need to see your personal ID to cash a check, I'm not quite sure that the teller has any business seeing that you committed that crime. I have, believe me, everybody knows my favorite line, I'm an accountant, not a lawyer, but it seems that might run afoul of the whole constitutional right to privacy in this state. So, I just express reservations that the bill certainly has come to the point that it deserves deliberation and for down vote on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kelly. Mayor Hawker, excuse me. we spent a lot of time thinking about that, and this isn't a mark on there forever. This is only for the length of time that the person is under orders from the court, and we think it merits keeping those people that have a problem with alcohol away from alcohol, at least for the specified time of their sentence and probation parole. I think it's worth it. For the number of people that have been made invalids, the people that have been killed, the expense the state goes through from the carnage on our highways, there are just so many reasons why we should be trying to prevent those people that have proven that they have a serious problem with alcohol. This doesn't affect a person that's just had one DUI. This is somebody that's a repeat offender. So I think that what we've been doing so far hasn't worked. I want to do something to prevent things from happening to my wife Gwen and all the and to our family, to happen to other innocent families across Alaska.
I don't want to prolong this, but just, and I sincerely appreciate the spirit which this has brought forward. But as you say, you're looking to combat the problem, stop something from happening that shouldn't happen. Again, it brings up a further equal protection issue because, sadly enough, I don't remember the last time I was carded when I was purchasing an adult beverage. A young, further inquirer here probably is carded regularly, but, this would be in or predominantly enforced against very young people. And those of us that are on the far side of 50 would certainly seem to probably escape without consequence. So this is a really hard animal to tie down, but that equal protection is of concern to me as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not every establishment is going to choose to check IDs. With the exception of just about everybody's going to check somebody that looks like there may be a problem about being 21. But there are a number of establishments throughout Alaska that just as a matter of course ask for IDs from everybody. Not only for alcohol, but for tobacco products. You walk in, and they say, you if you're going to buy alcohol or tobacco, they want to see your driver's license. There's a financial incentive here of a fine for those people that they can benefit if they do catch somebody doing it. Certainly, this is a tool to use when somebody becomes unruly or there may be a question about how inebriated they are, then they can ask for a driver's license or a state ID if they want to, even if they didn't do it to begin with. So if they happen to have the mark on there, then at that point it makes it a tool that they can use to keep alcohol away from that person. I think this is a good thing. It's not a perfect bill. It's not what I wanted to begin with, but I believe that it'll help save lives and help to save families. Thank you.
Thank you both for the discussion. Any else?
Yes, sir. I just want to say that every time I call with Carl Moses, he gets hurt. I wanted to thank Representative Crocker and the staff for all the hard work they've done on this over the interview in last and also that move HP1A out of finance to Texas and most of the work they did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any objections?
We appreciate it so much, and Gwen appreciates it.
Yeah. Well, it is. It wouldn't have happened.
Okay. Let's see. House Bill 377 was heard on March 15th. We did take public testimony, and we closed the public testimony. We do have people available for questions. If there are any additional questions, Mr. Pulaski, you will kind of update us on where we're at and what this is.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Pulaski, and I'm an aide to Representative Meyer. As we left the bill at the last hearing, we had heard from the architects, engineers, and land surveyors, and I believe the chairman of that board is online wishing to re-express their concern about the safety end of this bill. On the other side, we heard from representatives from the building community that took a different approach to the view of safety concerns. And as we left it last time, the committee was at a bit of an impasse in between. In the intervening period of time, we have looked at different language and have not been able to come to any conclusion about language that might bridge the gap between the concerns on both sides. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I believe we have each side again here for testimony, and I'd be happy to argue either direction for you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, that was sent to our office ahead of time, just before the committee hearing, by Mr. Maynard, who I believe wants to testify in opposition to the bill. And I made it available to the committee for their review.
There was some concern, I think, Mr. Kowalski, about how this would work with various cities and areas in the state. Maybe you could refresh our memory.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. There was a lot of concern about that expressed in that, on the one hand, the discussion was about building codes and how cities have plan review departments. The concern that the architects, engineers, and land surveyors brought forward was that the people doing the plan reviews might not be fully licensed structural engineers, which the argument was made, and I believe that the building code segment that I've seen that is highlighted talks about how when you get towards the third story in an earthquake zone or in a wind area, it is prohibited by the code. But in that it would be prohibited by the code, it wouldn't be allowed anyway. So it's kind of a moot point for the bill, I believe. But that's, I have not spoken to Mr. Maynard, and I don't believe I know what he wanted to say about it. At the same time, Mr. Chairman, the argument was that it does add cost, and building codes and plan review systems in place, there is an appropriate mechanism at the municipal level to ensure that these are built correctly. And then, if I could direct the committee in context to look at the statute, particularly on page 2, line 13 and 14, this was something that came up in the exceptions that already exist. A building for a person's own use and occupancy as a single-family residence and related site work for that building is completely exempt now. And that is where someone could build their own house to any level and then sell it, of course, on the market. And then, I believe Representative Holm in the last committee hearing had talked about how in that transaction period you have investigations and appraisals that happen from both sides and structural engineering reviews and the liabilities on the person buying the house back and forth. If that refreshes the committee's questions from last time, I believe that's where we're at.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and Mr. Chairman, if I might add one more thing. We did go out in the intervening time period per Representative Kelly's request and call the different building departments. And as I understand and receive responses back again, that they are still remaining neutral and have no position on the bill at all.
Mr. Chairman, I, in the previous testimony, I expressed some concern and reservation, in particular, out of deference to the AELS board, which, of course, is our state-constituted regulatory authority. And I honestly, as I said, I tend to defer these sort of decisions to those who know best, and this, we delegated that knowing best business to the folks on the ALS board, but I also need to pay very careful attention to the testimony and particularly the research that's been done in the intervening time between our previous hearing on this bill. And I appreciate you making your staff available to me in their research outside of the committee as well. And I truly, conclude myself that on the basis solely on the way the testimony presented before this committee, that have sort of violate my own premise of deference to the ALS board. In this case, I probably I don't concur with their conclusion on this bill. So I'm going to rectify my previous statements at this point, and I'd also kind of note that maybe we'll have to get it back to Mr. Maynard's chair of the ALS board. He gets got two demerits from me for not being able to spell surveyors correctly on his letterhead. So I think those two demerits eventually gave me the final weight to be happy to support your bill, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Any other directions?
Mr. Chairman, just certainly anecdotal, watching Channel 2 news last night, the night before, there was one other new government cost we had to the cost of building. I think the building association people are lamenting the fact that it's adding an average of another $7,000 per residential unit. You throw that to the platting costs that were added. I'm speaking of this county of Anchorage, platting costs that were added. Another $7,000 for the building permit, the escalation in property values, which certainly has ups and downs. And again, it's anecdotal that absent a clearly demonstrated public safety issue, which I did hear, just my own limited experience building my own house, so much of the elements that you buy them all pre-engineered, whether it's your trusses or your some of the construction units you buy, packages you buy are assembled and they're already pre-engineered. Should the engineers get a cut on those as well? You know, with all due respect to them, I don't blame any profession for not wanting to protect the turf that they have and give up something. That's, I just don't think there was a strong enough public safety concern demonstrated that was compelling, and there were just adding to the driving costs. It just scares me that I can barely afford to live in my district right now, and I'd sure like my nieces and nephews to be able to continue to live there, not have to have to make my point.
Very good. It's my understanding too, this would conform part of like the international building.
Representative Meyer, through the Representative Meyer, Mr. Chairman, I understand that is correct, though I believe Mr. Maynard was going to testify that there is some distinction in the residential code that was given to you here today, the two pages, that in a seismic area or an area with wind, it doesn't go up to the stories. At the same time, I just, as a 28-year-old Alaskan who pays back student loans, I'd like to thank Representative Stoltz for making that statement. As a person who's looked at buying a house in the current market, thank you, it's true.
Very good. Very
good. Well, I'm not going to object to the vote, but I actually have a lot more concerns than are being expressed today in terms of the load safety and other issues. So I'm just figuring out how to trust on this or be ready for the floor, because I agree this is a lot more concern.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, sir. This is such a nice call that I had a training to us with Howard Foster Meyer. And I'd like to move that out of finance.
Final bill here is House Bill 278, Contract System Bonds. Question, how does it work?
No. It makes it easier for everyone to take a shot.
Okay, good. Let's see. House Bill 278, Bill for cleanup on the 8th. On that date, we can take public testimony to close the public testimony. That bill back and forth. Discussion and amendments. Does it occur like you have amendments you want to make before we get into amendments? How do you want to refresh our members on what this bill does?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, I'm Representative Mike Hawker, District 32, Anchorage. And you get an entirely different perspective on the committee from this seat. And I point to the chairman that the sun glaring off the building through the window behind you is devastatingly blinding, and my greatest respect to those folks that had this seat before I sat down in it. The Yeah, we love General Raines. But Mr. Chairman, thank you for bringing this bill up today. This is the bill that is referred to as retirement system bonds or pension obligation bonds. We discussed at length what they were in the previous meeting here, but it's simply a way to allow the municipal bond. This bill, as it's written today, grants the municipal bond bank authority to facilitate these transactions on behalf of municipal employers in the state of Alaska. It's a simple availing yourself of what is essentially legal arbitrage available in this very unique circumstance. It's a permissive bill. It does not mandate any transaction. It does not authorize any bonding or any specific transaction. It specifically is an empowerment bill for the municipal bond bank. I'd be happy to discuss it more details at length, but when I was last before this committee, I was left with a charge of addressing a concerns that we all recognized still remain with the bill, and I do have an amendment that I'd be happy to discuss that I think gets us through those issues.
Okay. Any questions about the bill itself?
Your amendment replaces most of the bill.
Respectfully, it's a fairly long and complex bill. The amendment is somewhat long and complex, but I would be happy to explain it in a very simple and unusually short manner for myself.
Why don't we go ahead and take up Amendment 1 then? I'll move Amendment 1. Okay.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for moving Amendment 1 to the bill. If you don't mind, I'd kind of just like to walk through this with a kind of a quick sectional comment on this amendment, as it is a fairly lengthy amendment. Page 1, line 1. Actually, if I might, sir, with my apologies, sir, I'm getting halfway behind myself. I'd ask if you would consider an amendment to the amendment, because, again, there was a section in here that inadvertently was a remnant of a previous version we were working on that should not be included, and that would be on page 4. Of the amendment as it is written, would like to delete the lines 28 through 31. That whole section is not relevant.
So your amendment to the amendment is to delete lines 28 to 31 on page 4?
Yes, sir.
Any objection?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So back to the amendment itself, page 1, line 1, we do have the latitude here recognizing that once legal takes a look at the bill, they might want to propose a conforming title change, and it's the authority to make a conforming title change. Okay, then section 1 addresses the issue of this is would put an additional provision in section 1425.070 of current statute. This is our current statute that addresses the teacher's retirement system accounting contributions for the, and as I discussed this, TERS and PERS will refer to the retirement systems in place prior to the passage of Senate Bill 141 last year. This is the provision authorizing within TERS that an employer may prepay all, as in the first sentence, or the department can come up with regulations to permit an employer to prepay a portion of the employer's accrued actuarial liability, and provides that there's some constraints there that is essentially allowing regulatory authority to do that. And then specifically addressing the, and I guess it also goes on to say that shall be properly accounted for and credited to the employer making that payment. In other words, if a municipality or through a forest school system made a prepayment for City A, that cities B, C, and D don't get a chunk of it. It's ring fencing the additional contribution. Specifically addressing a current concern that Representative Kelly raised, which was absolutely one of our big concerns here. Lines on page 1, lines 19 through 22. This is the provision where we indemnify an employer who makes a prepayment, takes the initiative to do this, from something that may occur in the legislature if we make a general, in some way, discretionary contribution to assist the fund. We basically say a payment made by an employer under this section, together with the earnings and losses from investment of that payment, so everything that relates to that, shall not be considered in calculating that employer's share of any discretionary payment that may be authorized by the state of Alaska benefiting multiple employers. So, again, I'd certainly pass, accept your judgment on that language, but I think we've properly indemnified an employer making a payment from something that we may do that we desire to benefit the whole system so that they aren't, in that case, simply penalized for taking initiative. Section 2 of the bill goes into the state's statutory authority regarding municipal debt, its municipal debt authority. This answers some questions that were brought up in state affairs, as well as having been raised by the investment banking community, that allows, it clarifies that two or more municipalities may get together and do this sort of transaction. Although, truly that was in place, but we make very specific clarification here. Section B of that point also allows that those employees participating, the municipal bond bank may pool that activity itself so that, again, those communities, you know, certainly they don't have to further, again, it's permissive, it's not mandatory, but if it's appropriate, they can treat those communities in a block as they process such a transaction. Item C was another provision requested in various processes along the way, authorizing municipalities to enter into funds diversion agreements. And again, this is strictly permissive, but funds diversion agreement maybe with the bond authority authorized within the constraints of the provision here, them to say that, well, if we have money coming from the state for such and such a purpose, that money shall first go to pay off these obligations. Again, it's allowing, if it's appropriate, and again, if appropriate in a particular transaction, allowing the participants to grant essentially a better collateralization, better security interest to the municipal bond bank. We go to Section 3 on page 3 of the bill. This is actually Section 3 and 4 and 5, because PERS and TERS, the accounting, management, and contribution sections are in different sections of our statute. TERS is very separate from PERS. The statutory authority for PERS accounting is embodied in a different section of code. So these three sections recognize, once again, that the contributions shall go to an individual employer. They'll get individual credit for the transactions contemplated. And again, Section 5 and the amount of contribution sections for PERS, again, it is the authority for an employer to prepay all or part of their unfunded pension obligation for past service costs. And on page 4, the identical same language, the indemnity language, but relating to PERS transactions now, line 3 through line 5, talking about payments made, shall not be considered if we make a discretionary contribution on behalf of multiple employers. Obviously, page 1, line 10, that's a technical correction in here. The section here from lines 13 down through line 26, this is the section of legislative policy, the sort of the prefacing language and statutes guiding the management of the municipal bond bank. And what we've done in the bill, it was a little bit messy. What we've done is we've rewritten it so that we add a provision in their authority that just says very clearly says that if the bond bank or subsidiary of the bond bank desires to enter into one of these transactions, that it is, you know, to be consistent with the bond bank must continue to operate itself as a self-supporting operation with no expectation of subsidization with state funds. In other words, we're giving them the intent and authority saying, we don't want you to overextend yourself on here, so we got to help you. And then more importantly, the legislature does not intend that the bond bank authority or its subsidiary be utilized as a means to finance governmental employers under the pension obligation bond statutes beyond their capability to meet repayment schedules and debt service requirements. We felt it was just a good sidebar to put in here that says, makes it very, very clear that we are not going to assist municipalities beyond their means, but we do very much want to grant the bond bank the authority to pursue such transactions that are within the means of the communities. And then, as discussed before, the last four lines on that page are irrelevant, were deleted from the amendment. And the very last page here, we were requested by the University of Alaska to include them as those folks specifically authorized to contemplate such transactions. Answer.
Very good. Thank you, President Hawker. There's a lot of questions.
Yeah, beyond their means, and their theories, what about what constraints are there at the university? Because basically it's got receipt authority through tuition grants and state general funds under that. They're always going to be coming back to the state to see what they for financing their pension obligation bonds.
Through the chair, Representative Weirach, again, in the This is empty authority for the university to contemplate such a transaction. You know, they are subject to the various internal accounting and administrative controls that such that they are that we do have over the university. The market itself, the capital markets, would certainly regulate any regulate any such contemplated transaction with and taking into consideration those the sidebars that we have in our administrative and accounting controls over the university. And I suspect it would be a difficult challenge, or be a challenge for the university to secure the conclusion of such a transaction if the, in this case, the lenders, those institutional investment community, did not feel they had adequate assurance that there was sufficient legislative support to be repaid. So again, I think it's, again, it gets back into the capital markets are very self-regulating. I don't believe we've overexposed the state to any to the university encumbering or accomplishing something that would not be appropriately approved through all of our existing executive budget act processes. But I certainly, if that was to be identified as a further problem, this bill, I mean, first to recognize, that's what goes forward, get it through the House. We have still a trip through the other body with this one, and you know, some very good, I'm looking forward to getting over there and having those very good minds with other perspectives than we may have looked at this also contribute to the fleshing out of this bill. Mr. Chairman, if I might, when you're headed into that body, it is very good to be good to them.
Well, sort of got to figure out some way to address the unfunded liability. This probably is one that the last retirement management board is going to address, certainly because now, as of this week, they estimate we have an unfunded liability of $6.9 billion, which is up more than a billion from last year. So there's some heat under all kinds of solutions.
To that point, sir, I'd just like to say, this is but a, it is intended, as we've stated before, this is one tool in the toolbox. You know, honestly, don't know if there's a application for it, but it's certainly a tool that one would want to have at our discretion, or our disposal, to use with the appropriate discretion.
Very good. And it is this option, but this stuff is required.
That would be very, yeah, absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Just a note, line 25 on page 4, I think we want a comma after note. Instead of period.
Mr. Chairman, I would concur completely. I stand appropriately chastised being sort of the punctuation nut here.
I wanted to talk with Mark Waugh and Tom Gray on this. We might have more time on this than Mr. Chairman. We might have time to talk with Mark Waugh and Tom Gray. I'd like to talk with Mr. Bader Buchan on this and then Mr. Barnhill. See if there's anybody online here to talk.
Yes, we do ask the folks
And I say the amendment was drafted in cooperation with my office and legislative legal, but I at this juncture did not have the Department of revenue here to testify one way or the other on this bill.
I think I anticipate your position a little bit, Uncle Senator. That doesn't sway me. I just want to get sort of where they're coming from this.
As I stated, I'm very happy to acknowledge that I've been told the Department of Revenue does not support these transactions, but that I do believe we are an independent body. We do establish policy here. I don't believe we're here to take orders from the Department of Revenue. And I think, I believe that we've had a sufficient body of testimony that would give us the comfort in moving this forward as a policy statement by the House of Representatives, certainly this committee to the floor of the House.
Just a quick follow-up, because I tend to agree with Representative Parker. I'm not sure in light of the liability that the state's communities are facing, where how sound their opposition would be, so I sort of want to bump that.
Just for the record, in case there are some other questions, we have Stacy Koshaw with the Willis Trust in Law, and Mrs. Sati with Northwest Securities. Paul Boone with Merrill Lynch. If there's any questions for those folks, they are a little. I would agree with Christian Warwick. I think we have to do something. I think this is the best that I've seen thus far. I mean, that's perfect. Any other questions or comments, Chris and Warwick?
Well, the best, I think, is to appropriate funds to address the unfunded liability. I think testimony has been all for the. Been on that issue unanimously that if you have the cash, you should pay it as the unfunded liability. But if that's not going to happen, you have to figure out something else.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, response to keeping in mind, this is not, it does not contemplate addressing the state's liability. This is a tool to assist other governmental employers, particularly municipalities and their school districts. So, and also, to me, with sincere respect, it's really not going to be applicable to the state of Alaska, and that's so. In some ways, I'd argue that the Department of Revenue's opposition to the state conducting such a transaction is not relevant in the discussion and debate of this particular bill. We have very strong testimony from the municipal employers and the Alaska Municipal League. Someplace in your packet, there's their letter of endorsement that they would like the opportunity to pursue these transactions in the commercial financial markets, and recognizing that a transaction may or may not ever be concluded.
I think the concern may be that the state is ultimately responsible for such a that these bonds should fall. Is that correct or not?
Again, Mr. Chairman, this falls into the category of moral obligation debt, which would be the issue here. It has not been a direct liability of the state.
Okay. Very good.
This is really tailored towards those larger communities that have financial wherewithal to fund the Florida pension obligation bond. And then, for example, if you take a small community like Kilmina or something, they're sort of going to be out of their league, isn't it? Because they're going to have the financial whatever base
through the chair. Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, the reason why the pooling provisions were incorporated here were specifically to give the greatest possible opportunity for the smaller and less sophisticated communities who are probably feeling the crunch of the pension obligation the most to potentially avail themselves of this opportunity. The purpose of the municipal bond bank in this is to act as a regulator and a moderator, perhaps a governor, over such a transaction, make certain, and again, one of the more reasons why we established that very clear, purposeful, that you're not going to help somebody get in over their head, but you're there to help them absolutely minimize the cost associated with satisfying their pension liability. So this really is more directed at this junk, as this bill is here, it is really more to assist the mid and smaller sized communities than a larger community who most likely would not avail themselves of municipal bond bank assistance.
Anything else, Mr. Ward? Congressman Kelly.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. We're all struggling with, you know, we took the first step in 141 to try to stop the bleeding. I can't help but comment now that the brand spanking new consultant has been brought on board and has opined as to the size of the liability. It's now nearly $7 billion. There were a lot of people last year that were just railing against us that this thing would self-solve if we just wait and that sort of thing. I think it's much worse than we thought. Here we are with the employer's line now with higher terminal number on percent salary. When you get up past 50%, you know, you don't have a sustainable in the environment. But I think that what Representative Hawker has here is one tool. It's optional. We now have protection built in through the changes that have been made so that if there's an upside, that is if we do come up with the cash, they can take advantage of that. If there's a downside, there's been as much protection as you can reasonably put in, recognizing the state stands behind this somewhere anyway, or we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it all the time. There's been a reasonable protection on the downside. And someone can take advantage of this and take advantage of what appears to be a reasonable expectation of an arbitrage, and I think it may be make some anyway, my comment is this, that I think it's one tool. And that some folks may be able to take advantage of it. I'd like to see us make some progress in this arena this year. I have a bill in front of the Finance Committee sponsored, and that I've worked a bit with Representative Wirebach on the front of Ways and Means, and it's got troubles. It's got some great ideas in it on what's trying to be accomplished. There's some difficulty on the gas interest. Putting that asset in the fund to take care of the same kind of liability. We're struggling on several fronts, and I appreciate the Representative Hawker on this front to bring something forward that may be able to help some folks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And Mr. Warwick, let me come back to you. Said you spent probably the most time on this issue than any of us if you're wasting meat somebody.
I'm just a little confused about it. It's not for the state, it's for munis. Why are we in the university, allowing the university the possibility?
I guess we're getting back to the amendment that's before us.
I think we adopted the amendment. Did we reserve any objection to the amendment? I guess there was objection.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Do you withdraw your objection?
Yes.
Okay. Any other objection to the amendment? All right, so we have a bill before us as amended.
Yeah, I'm just concerned about the university. What's different about the university that we're
allowing
them to possibly do?
I'll be honest, it was a request brought to me by the university, and with apologies, I don't have, I hesitate to speak on their motivation other than it seems to be in that they do have a large pension obligation here, that the ability to utilize the services, the professional talent, the professional resources available through the Municipal Bond Bank to address such a transaction, should it be approved through the, through our existing, management regulatory authority over the university, that it would seem to be not an unreasonable inclusion in the bill. If I might, just before we pass, I got to pull out the entire context of code here. But again, this is in the definition of a governmental employer. And if I might look at it within context, a governmental employer means the state of Alaska or a municipality or other state or municipal government entity within the state, including an agency, instrumentality, district, school, district, public corporation, department, division, or other subdivision of the state or municipality in a capacity as an employer. So I think what we had there was, this is one of those I truly believe that the university per se would have been included in that definition, but they'd requested specific recognition. So again, just deferring to those folks that brought points forward they'd like to have included.
Part of laws already included that
definition with legal interpretation. That, as not a lawyer, not qualified to practice law, but I appreciate the legal consultation that would confirm my opinion, sir.
The other thing is this is part of the twin zippers, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chairman. The issue of school districts down maybe they're also in the gamut, so that somehow they determined that they wanted to take advantage of this. It sounds to me like your definition might even include them. I'm getting a nod, yes, over there. So if I think Representative Kudel, I'm here backing that. If we did kind of confirm that it includes all of them, I'd like to hear that. Somewhere along the track.
Yes. Yes, I've not been Kelly Wyrock and back to Hawker again. But yeah, you certainly can, and I certainly say that this bill has been, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, bill has very clearly been crafted to encompass school district obligations with the TERF system. However, again, most of the school systems, you know, they have a higher regulatory authority, whether it be their local administration, the local city, or what, but it certainly be, it was to grant the greatest possible latitude in perhaps structuring a pooling interest.
If I might go ahead, and the term is different here from what the Norwest folks used. They use intercept funds, and looks like you covered that in here as well. So there may be some ways that they might be able to participate. Is that fair?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I believe I concur with you here. Certainly the intent is, and that when you said intercept, or in this case, the point of a funds diversion, which would be a way to intercept funds. But now again, I believe the capital markets will prevail, and if it is too risky for an investor, transaction is simply not going to occur. Yes, sir.
Did you have a question? Okay, there's a lot. Just one final comment, Mr. Those, the testimony that I have heard is that those communities or states that have floated pension obligation bonds are in serious trouble right now in eastern United States and Illinois because they saw as a panacea the solution to their unfunded liability if the market went to heck. So did their obligation. Huge obligation that they have basically. So there's a risk to this as well. This is not a panacea. This is not a solved problem. And it also may give some illusion to some entity that quotes its pension obligation that they solve a problem. In fact, they have a different kind of debt to pay, and they still are obligated to pay the debt. So there is a risk. There is a risk in doing this that it gives a false sense of security to the poor community. So there it still is a problem. This helps address it. Has to be very
prudent, cautious. Mr. Chairman, Arifin Wyrock, there is a very long record of testimony on this bill in both the State Affairs Committee and now the Finance Committee. In fact, if we pulled up the record of the testimony presented at the last meeting, that acknowledges the point you made exactly, that there, you know, any financial transaction involves risk. There was a lengthy record of testimony on the issue of a hard obligation versus a soft obligation. There's also, we have had a lengthy history of testimony, I believe also in the Finance Committee, but certainly in the State Affairs Committee, that did discuss where these sort of transactions have been had in the past had been definitely misused and abused, and we've identified also the reasons why those transactions were not successful. Largely, they occurred in certain, in effect, even I believe the bill packet here has the rating agency discussion, some Standard & Poor's white papers, where they're specifically, and then the ORIC paper that I submitted along with the bill, which was a bond counselor's primer on pension obligation bonds, to specifically discussed cases where, and the reasons why some of these transactions failed. And those failures would have largely occurred when the transaction was being used improperly or involved unrealistic assumptions and expectations, particularly where in some of those Eastern situations, government was essentially trying to extract money and borrowing against their pension plan to fund their general operations. Times, the state of Alaska in those period, that era, of course, we had our Trans-Alaska pipeline and an source of sustainable revenue. But communities that are state, just jurisdictions that use these too aggressively certainly wound up in a undesirable circumstance. Some transactions were conducted on the very unrealistic expectations of being able to expect earnings literally in the stratosphere, sustained earnings into the stratosphere. All of the testimony brought forward specific to this bill has pointed out that we are working in a realm of fiscal reality here. We are looking at what is absolutely proven and achievable, documented returns on the investment of the state of Alaska's pension funds, which has historically, empirically exceeded 8%. Again, the investment banking community has pointed that the all-in costs of executing these sort of transactions, they believe, and again, these are the experts who I would rely on, they believe that such a transaction could be executed somewhere in the less than 6% range. So again, it's an arbitrage here, but we're talking about a 2 to 2.5 to 3% arbitrage, which doesn't sound like much, but when we look at the obligation and the size of these obligations and the satisfaction of these obligations over time, again, the miracle of compound interest in this case works to the benefit of the employer. So we have brought this forward with no false expectations and with a tremendous amount of testimony caveating the inherent risks. And again, I invite anyone to look back to the testimony and very, very clearly, I believe that the situations you have brought up have been acknowledged. And we've pointed out to where the lessons learned in the community, not in Alaska, but in other jurisdictions, have been more than incorporated into this proposal.
Okay, very good. Also, too, for the committee's attention, there is a new fiscal note. Those actually changed it to indeterminate, basically, because they don't know study or who's going to use
it. And, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The previous fiscal note, this includes the exact same information as was in the previous fiscal note, which was a hypothetical, like what if there was a $1 billion transaction executed. That same information is now in the notes to this, and simply saying this is should any transaction be undertaken, the impact would be using the same numbers as were in the previous fiscal note. But again, we have no idea if there ever will be a transaction completed.
Okay. Very good. Any other discussion?
Just back to the fact that we just learned from Buck that this thing is near $7 billion now. That's 20% of the permanent fund. And when I first came down to Juneau last year, I thought it might be a good idea. It turned out that it was not possible to make it fly. That somehow in the public sector, the employees might then brought to the table some of those that were involved in benefits, the cost of which are higher than it looks like we're able to afford. But it's a frustration to me that we're sitting here now, we've identified $7 billion. And although we think everybody's in this, there are some folks out there that aren't. I know legislators and municipal officers and borough people and law folks and the administration. Everybody's got their feet in this straw, but we're wrong there. It isn't everybody. There are a whole lot of Alaskans out there that don't. that have got to get more and more upset with this. So when we just say we're going to solve it for the cash, we run into that wall. When you try to do it the way we're talking about here, that has its difficulties. The bill in the Representative YWAX committee that I've been helping has its difficulties. We've got ourselves in a real difficult situation here, and I wish there were more participants at the table. But as I look ahead, and you look at what is going to have to be done, it's not just going to be cash, it's going to work.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and I don't want to belay this, I know we need to get on to other things today, but the point Representative Wyrock had made, and followed by Representative Kelly here, on, I believe, you know, the statement made that paying cash up front is the best solution. There are also problems with that solution in that if we pay our obligation over time as people continue to be employees, we also end up picking up a great deal of other fund sources that do not come out of the state's pocket, that if we paid off this liability today with all state money, we would forego the ability to mitigate our obligation with other fund sources, particularly that of federal government and receipt-supported services and all the other fund sources that go into meeting our state's payroll. So I just really want to emphasize, as Representative Kelly said, Representative Wyrock, there are no simple solutions. There is no silver bullet. This is but a tool in a toolbox that I think belongs in our toolbox, sir.
Okay. Thank you. President Warwick, last comment?
Yeah, just finally, the bill, the appropriation measures I introduced would have paid substantial amounts to the TERS system and some to the PERS system, but that is distinction in those appropriations bills recognize the benefit of not of using some of those other fund sources for PERS and the TERS. So, it's more complex than simply cash, and I recognize that. I'm just saying, if we could take a back magic bullet and then that we could do it, there's too many political and financial realities going on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Foster.
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move.
Foster, go ahead. I do have a question. Yeah, I wonder if Mr. Representative Hawker would be amenable to leading the University of Alaska at this point from the amendment. And I make that amendment with this in mind. Number one, it's a new program, so we have to see where it goes. Number two, it does carve out the University of Alaska in a way that does link in a lot of other entities and adds a certain amount of complexity. And number three, since given this does have a way to go, I just think that at this point, for me, it's easier to pull the swab. It does not include the university simply because it is a new type of program. I wonder if you're amenable to that.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to accept that amendment.
Okay, so would that be the last set from page 5?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, good.
It's actually deleting page 5.
Okay.
I'm not going to object to the change in the amendment that's been approved, but want to make this point. I think that what I've heard, the language may well include them anyway, as well as the school districts. And the university has a significant work problem related to the purchasers' problems in that they're ramping up this past service plus normal cost rate. That's got to be solved. That is an unforeseen benefit to folks that this may play some way in solving. I don't think it's completely solved. But all I would ask is this: I agree with what Representative Wyrock has asked and Representative Hawker has agreed to. As long as we don't just jerk it out, but we go take a look at it. We pull it out now, but we. I would ask that you take a look at whether it should be in.
Mr. Chairman, I think I just observe also that I am certain as this bill moves its way through the bodies, if it does actually reach the point of being a law, one of the persons who's going to have their fingerprints on this will be our good friend, Senator Wilken, who is a great advocate and champion of university issues, and I would make it my warranty to you is to make it a point to bring this issue up specifically with him, with the representatives of the university before it came to fruition.
Thank you, Chairman. And the reason I moved to strike is because notwithstanding significant amounts of annual increases in funds to K-12, the biggest problem with them realizing and putting that money into the classroom and the teacher salaries, which are the biggest variance, are their
payments that have to make to the presenter through the presenter's contributions. So if they didn't have that obligation, a lot more of the money were appropriated into that huge hole. We'd be doing it in the classroom if we'd be given a lot more computer content. And so to distinguish the university from, say, the school districts, to me, does that it raises a whole issue with respect to the finances of the institution, with the politics of what we're doing, and with the proposal that's on the table, and that it is a new thing for a lot of people. And so given that the record reflects your comments, Representative Kelly, and what Representative Hogger's going to do, I still want to stand on the event, but I'm open to what happens sort of down the line as it comes back.
All right, very good. Is there any objection to the amendment with the understanding that Representative Hogger is going to investigate this further? Some adjustments need to be made. They will be made down the line. Okay, no objections, then amendments. This is amendment to the amendments. It's amendment two, because we had one on page four. Okay, amendment two, there's no objection, so amendment two is also accepted. Okay, anything else? No, President.
Yes, sir, I'll go ahead and move out of the finance committee, HB 278, otherwise known as the cluster bill, out of committee, as amended, but in good organization, and we've had.
Okay, any objections?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's see, before we turn, here's make sure you sign your sheets. Tomorrow, or Monday, we're going to change directions and start the discussion on PPT. The co-chairman is here, let's go through this, but he's not, so I will. Again, it starts at 2 o'clock. We're anticipating having both this fast track supplemental and the operating budget on the floor next week, so probably starting a little bit later. 2 to 5 every day, 7 to Friday, we'll go back to our normal time, 11:30, and then we are planning on having testimony on Saturday from 10 to 2. So, Adam, have a good weekend.
I'm going to come see you before we got it done, so. Yeah.